Don't spend another winter with your home colder than it should be. Hi, I'm Roy Spencer with PermaSeal. We measure the amount of heat loss and recommend solutions to keep it comfortable. Call PermaSeal for your free estimate, 800-421-SEAL, or visit permaseal.net.
This is John Williams. Bob, are you a basketball fan? Are you into the whole bracket thing this year?
I'm not. I tried to do it last year, and I lost interest after the first round. I thought, I'm going to give it a go, and I tried. I really did.
Well, I'm sorry, because did you have any money in your bracket? Because I think that motivates people who are new to the game. There's nothing that makes watching the NCAA basketball tournament so interesting as having the chance to win $100. Get, 10 people, everybody put 10 bucks in, and now and it's amazing how transformative that can be, Bob.
That gets you involved. Okay, well, maybe. Well, is it too late to start a bracket now?
The way it's going this year, I don't think it much matters anyway. That's the other great thing, I think, Bob, about the brackets, is that having a lot of knowledge about basketball doesn't really give you much of an advantage.
Oh.
So, a novice like you could do pretty well. Maybe next year. I don't think most people will let you into their pools right now, Bob, so that may be something for you next year.
Well, I'll just kind of watch in the wings here. But I like that the buzzer beaters are cool, and I like that
these
teams that some of these guys, they may never go on to the pros or anything, but they can go really far, and I think that's really cool. So I do like aspects of it.
It is one of the best things we do here in America. I know that sounds like a grand statement, but it really is. It's David and Goliath play, and son of a gun, David throws that rock and it hits. David's do well in this thing. In fact, there was Baylor playing Yale. Baylor in the ridiculous canary yellow uniforms playing Yale, the Ivy League team who hadn't been in the tournament in a thousand years. And so afterwards, I'll just play one little soundbite for you. So after the game, the teams have to put a couple of their players up for the media to be interviewed. Frankly, I understand why they do that at the pro level and why the coaches should, but I don't know that the players have to be dragged out, particularly the losing players. These are just kids. They just had their heart ripped out. Now they're sitting there in front of microphones and a bunch of people are asking questions. And sometimes sports questions are really impossible to answer, like what happened out there? And you think, well, we lost, you dope. I don't know. I did my best. So here is the media core asking one of the Baylor players, how is it that Yale out-rebounded them?
They have more rebounds.
You said it out-rebounded. I was surprised. You did. 36-32. Mm-hmm. How does Yale out-rebound Baylor?
You go up and grab the ball off the rim when it comes off, and then you grab it with two hands, and you come down with it, and that's considered a rebound. So they got more of those than we did.
Any more questions for the student-athletes?
Any more questions for the smart-ass student-athletes? But I'm completely with the kid on that. I'm like, you know what? That is the perfect answer. That is the perfect answer. Now, last year in the ESPN brackets, 11.57 million people signed up. And the person who won was from Hawthorne Woods, and I think he's on the line right now. Sam Holtz, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Okay, now, is that Butch or is that Sam?
This is Sam.
That's Sam. How are you, Sam? This is John Williams. You're on WGN Radio.
I am great. How are you?
Pretty good. Your voice is a little deeper. It sounds like you're on a speakerphone there, but you are now 13 years old, right?
Yeah, I'm 13.
Yeah. Last year, you were 12, obviously, and won or tied for first place in the ESPN bracket battle. And that became kind of famous because you were too young to actually participate. And so you weren't able to get all of the prizes that were due you. Do I remember that right, Sam?
Yeah, I wasn't able to get any of the major prizes that for ESPN, but there was a couple other companies that stepped up and gave some prizes to me because ESPN was unable to.
Yeah. So I talked to you a few days ago before the tournament started. And I asked you, what were your final four, and did you have any surprise picks? And didn't you say that Purdue was going to lose?
I said, no, I had the opposite. I said Purdue was going to go pretty far in the tournament.
And how far did you have Michigan State going there, Sam?
I had Michigan State to the Elite Eight. Well, I made three brackets, And then my best one right now, I have Michigan State going to the Elite Eight. And then my original one, I had them going to the championship. So,
yeah, you too, huh? Well, yeah. How would you say you're doing? Did you sign up for the ESPN, and where do they have you placed right now?
I signed up for ESPN, but my best bracket right now is in the top 100,000. But the bracket with the most PPR right now is in like the 5 million, but it's still early to call. So I'm not really sure where I'm going to end up right now.
Yeah. So you can jump a lot of spots depending on what happens. So what's your final four there, Sam?
My final – in which bracket, the original or
– Yeah, well, I don't know. Give me your best shot. Give me the bracket you have the most confidence in.
Well, the final four was Virginia, Kansas, Oregon, and Virginia, Kansas, Oregon, and Indiana.
Yeah, those. Here's the lesson that we learn the hard way every year. Don't take Big Ten teams to go far in the tournament.
Yes, I just learned that, and probably going to use that next year and so on.
Well, I don't know. But next year we'll all love Michigan or somebody and think, no, this is the year. I just thought Tom Izzo was, you know, the kind of guy that could get through even a bad game. He's a good game day coach, good X's and O guy, good talent. So those of us who thought, well, that can't go wrong, learned a lesson. Hey, by the way, you were on with Steve Cochran, is that right?
Yes, I was.
And like everybody, at least Steve and I felt the same way. We thought ESPN should make this right by you, but legally they said they couldn't. They could, but they didn't want to. Fine. Then other companies stepped up and said, well, we'll send your family to Hawaii and we'll give you scholarship money. And so you ended up with about the same value of stuff as you would have had you been over the age of 18. And then Steve, as I recall, said he's going to send you Lou Malnati's pizza and everything on the prize list, right?
Yes, he did.
Yeah. How did that work out?
I've never received any of those.
All right. Well,
I just love pizza, too.
All right. Well, I'm real sorry to hear that, Sam. Another valuable life lesson learned there. I'll tell you what, I've got your phone number, and I'm sure this sounds hollow, but I'll tell the staff to send you guys some Lou Malnati's, okay?
Thank you very much.
Yeah, don't wait by the door, but I'm going to try and make that happen. Okay, Sam Holt?
Okay, thank you.
All right, take care. Bye now.
You too.
13 years old and still not doing too bad. Virginia, Kansas, Oregon, Indiana. How about this Adam LaRoche story, huh? I've been reading his statement. Have you too? And I wonder what you think about that. I don't have anything especially inspired or unique to say about this story of the White Sox slugger who, and I'm putting air quotes around slugger now, hit 207 last year. But what a strange story. And I don't know if you have something to say about that, but we're going to open up the phone lines in a minute. You can call right now, 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200. I like the way Bob Nightingale began his story in the USA Today, today. He said this, "Now, do we really think Chicago White Sox Executive Vice President Ken Williams acted alone here?" And then he said, "Several players and staff members privately complained to White Sox management recently about the constant presence of LaRoche's 14-year-old son, Drake, in the White Sox clubhouse. He was there for 120 games last year. 120 games. Apparently, no one ever told LaRoche, these players, these other people on the team, that were uncomfortable with the constant presence of what everybody says is a great kid. But, you know, he's still a kid. He was sometimes doing drills on the field with the players. He was always around, and some of the players evidently weren't thrilled about that. No one told LaRoche. But they did express their views to the management. And that put the White Sox, that put Kenny, in an awkward position. I think the other mistake they made was right out of the blocks. By the way, this is me just opining now. I think the mistake they also made was, all right, 2 years, $26 million, and the first thing the guy says, They throw that down in front of him, and he says, the most important thing to me is that my 14-year-old son be able to hang out with me all of the time, the way he had evidently in Washington. I don't know. That's kind of a red flag to me. We'll pick it up here in a minute. And I'm interested in your thoughts on where this story is. Did Kenny Williams and the White Sox make a mistake here? You can call me right now. John Williams on WGN.
They have more rebounds. You're sitting it out rebounded. I was surprised. You did. 36-32. How does Yale out rebound Baylor?
You go up and grab the ball off the rim when it comes off, and then you grab it with two hands, and you come down with it, and that's considered a rebound. So they got more of those than we did.
Any more questions for the student-athletes?
That makes me smile every time. I'm afraid you're going to have to listen to it a few more times before we're done at 3. So we're talking about the Adam LaRoche story now. You know, he said in his statement, he issued one, and you've probably heard about it or read a little of it. He said, all of the statements from my teammates, past and present, should say enough. He's talking about how the guys in the clubhouse endorse his son. He's a good kid, and he's no trouble. Those comments from all of the people who have interacted with Drake are a testimony to how he carries himself. Prior to signing with the White Sox, my first question to the club concerned my son's ability to be part of the team. They should have nipped that in the bud. They really wanted him to hit. He really wanted $26 million. That little thing about my 14-year-old gets to hang around, that should have been a red flag to both sides. That should not have, you know, whatever the deal was that Kenny made, they should not have made that deal about that little detail. He goes on to say, the 2015 season presented no problems as far as Drake was concerned, parentheses, my bat and our record are another story, exclamation point, close parentheses. That sort of cheeky comment about the fact that he hit 207 last year, you can almost see the emoticon unhappy face next to it, strikes me as being a little odd. Talk about not appreciating what really is going on here. If he'd hit 300 last year, do you think we'd be having this conversation? Let's pick up some phone lines. We'll start with Paul on line one. You're on WGN. Paul, what did you want to say? Hi.
Hey, John, I'd wonder if other players bring their kids to the games as well, and we're just not hearing about it. That said, I heard that the agreement between Williams and LaRoche was more of a handshake. Sure, you could bring your kid on. I don't know if it was in the contract. My concern is that if I was a player, can I bring my kid to the game too? And let's just say that that's not the situation. I would almost feel weird having a kid in the locker room while I'm changing, while I'm trying to have a conversation, you know, that thing kind of comes to mind. Now, if all the players say that, hey, we support him, you know how it is? It's like me saying, hey, all my friends think I'm a great guy. Well, no, not all my friends think I'm a great guy. Many of them do, but not all. I'm wondering if that's the same situation here, where many of the players think that, hey, it's okay to have Drake in the room, and maybe a couple people did say something, and I'm kind of on Kenny's side with this, you know. But I think there's still more to hear the story. I just think it's a little awkward. I don't know. I mean, not everyone could bring their kid to school to work every day. You know what I mean?
No, I think you're onto something. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. So that's just my thing. I don't know. I think there's more to hear about this, and I'd be curious as to what happens, especially what Reinsdorf says in the next couple of weeks too.
How about it? Thanks for the phone call.
Thanks.
That's Paul. And to his point, here, going back to the USA Today story by Bob Nightingale, while almost every major league organization welcomes such bonding, kids hanging around, the White Sox are a really family-centric team. They famously are, to a fault they are. While almost every major league organization welcomes such bonding, Drake was something of an outlier. Even Ken Griffey Jr., perhaps baseball's most famous son, was only in the big league clubhouse with his dad a handful of games a year. We'll pause here, update you on the news with Bob Kessler on WGN. So let's do a little bit of this. It's been an interesting week on a number of fronts. Earlier this week, President Obama said,
as valedictorian of his high school class, he had...
Isn't this a great story? So here is President Obama, and he is at the Rose Garden with Joe Biden standing by his side, and there's Merrick Garland, and they're about to announce that he will be the president's choice. And then he tells this story about what Garland did when he was in high school.
As valedictorian of his high school class, he had to deliver a commencement address. The other student speaker that day spoke first and unleashed a fiery critique of the Vietnam War. Fearing the controversy that might result, several parents decided to unplug the sound system, and the rest of the student's speech was muffled. And Merrick didn't necessarily agree with the tone of his classmates' remarks, but stirred by the sight of a fellow student's voice being silenced, he tossed aside his prepared remarks and delivered instead, on the spot, a passionate, impromptu defense of our First Amendment rights.
When Garland finally got up there...
This is the greatest honor of my life. Other than Lynn agreeing to marry me 28 years ago.
And then he almost loses it, composes himself, observes that his daughter, when it was announced that he would be the president's choice, was hiking outside of cell service and wasn't able to get the news. So then they went back to the Senate Republicans and Democrats, and they said, okay, well, how about this guy? Excellent academic chops, 63 years old, so we don't have to live with it, good or bad, too long. And a guy who has actually been serving on a judicial, on a federal court for over 20 years. So no rookie to the game. Mitch McConnell said,
it is a president's constitutional right to nominate a Supreme Court justice, and it is the Senate's constitutional right to act as a check on a president and withhold its consent. The American people may well elect a president who decides to nominate Judge Garland for Senate consideration. The next president may also nominate somebody very different. Either way, our view is this. Give the people a voice in filling this vacancy. The American people are perfectly capable of having their say, on this issue. So let's give them a voice. Let's let the American people decide. The Senate will appropriately revisit the matter when it considers the qualifications of the nominee the next president nominates.
Now, there's Mitch McConnell. He called it the Biden rule, by the way, and we'll get to that point in just a minute. So that's kind of maddening, isn't it? But then Elizabeth Warren was asked about it, and she's certainly a Democrat U.S. Senator. Elizabeth Warren, some people thought, was trying to gin up a run for the presidency herself. So she was on the CBS Morning News this week. And this is the strangest interview. You know, if one of the takeaways from all of this is that politicians on either side of the aisle these days just don't answer the questions or aren't listening to the people. More Americans than not, by a large margin, at least want the Senate to hear this guy out and then give him a thumbs up or thumbs down. My own view is that Republicans particularly should be listening to the people since their party is fracturing beneath them. So, doggone it, McConnell, what a tin ear you've got about this issue or about anything right now if you're going to play hardball that way. Okay, that's my take on it. But now here comes Elizabeth Warren on the other side, and they're just going to lob some softballs to her. She's a Democrat. She's sitting there on the CBS Morning News, and they're asking her about the president's choice.
Are you enthusiastic in your support of Judge Garland?
You know, the way I think of this, filling a Supreme Court vacancy is one of the most solemn tasks undertaken by this government. This isn't supposed to be a circus.
With respect, Senator, the question I asked was, will you support Judge Garland?
But that's the whole point right now, is that we want Judge Garland to come over. I want to meet with him. I want to look at his credentials. I want to see him perform in a hearing.
But, Senator, the Republicans are now pointing to Joe Biden's comments back in 1992 when he said a nomination should not be put forward in an election year. So why is this different this time in 2016?
Look, let's be clear. Just go back and look at the history. Every single Republican, every single Supreme Court nominee to a vacant position has had its hearing and a vote.
Senator, let me turn to the presidential race in 2016. All of your female Democratic senators have endorsed Senator Hillary Clinton. You have not yet made an endorsement. Will you do it before the convention?
Yeah, I don't have a timeline for this, but I got to tell you, watching what's been going on the Democratic side really makes me prouder to be a Democrat.
You know that your lack of an endorsement at this stage, though, has raised some questions. Let me ask you this. Do you believe that Senator Clinton should release the transcripts of her speeches to Goldman Sachs?
Look, I think that our candidates are out doing what they should do in a primary. They are debating the issues.
You're not answering my question, Senator.
They answer for themselves. What I'm doing is I'm telling you what I think should be going on right now in this election.
Which is a yes or no question. It's a yes or no question. Should she release the transcripts or not?
What I told you is I think that the primaries are doing exactly what they should be doing.
What will it take for you to make an endorsement of either candidate?
I don't have
what more do you need to hear?
What I'm glad to see is what's happening right now, and that is that the Democrats are out talking about the issues. I think it makes it very distinct what happens between our side and what's happening over on the other side.
Someone
said they're doing some kind of reality show. We're out here trying to talk about the issues that affect American people.
And so are we.
Good luck to you on that, Charlie. They need to check the Kool-Aid in the green room over there at CBS. So we turn to the Mincing Rascals now. It's a podcast that I record with Steve Bertrand from WGN Radio News, Eric Zorn, the columnist from the Chicago Tribune, and Kristen McQuarrie, who writes editorials for the Tribune and sometimes writes columns in that fine newspaper. So we sit down every Friday and we kick around some issues. Yeah, we've been talking presidential politics the last several months, but we spent some time also talking about this topic, this Merrick Garland thing. And Steve Bertrand was talking about Donald Trump and why people are gravitating towards him. And from there, he segued to the nomination of Garland. So we'll pick it up there here on WGN.
It seems like one of the things we've sort of been talking about or not talking about through this whole cycle is whether the voters are stupid, right? That Donald Trump is doing so well. Are the voters, you know, are we trusting the American people? Are they completely misguided? It seems to me that with what Mitch McConnell and others are saying is, he's implying that he thinks, yes, they are. I mean, this idea that we should let the people decide on this just makes me furious. The people have decided on this. You know, they reelected President Obama. He's the decider. And when they use this language like, well, we should let the American people decide with the election, I think they're playing the voters for fools. They think that they're too stupid to understand that.
The voters also nominated Trump.
Well, the Republican voters so far have nominated Trump.
And the GOP establishment is trying to maybe quietly undo that. So it's pretty
consistent. What does the table think of Obama's poker play here, if it is a poker play, of nominating someone who is really middle of the road? I mean, like I said, like the dream candidate for Republicans from a Democrat. This is the best they could possibly hope for. And trying to lure them into changing their minds.
Yeah, but that makes it sound political. I mean, I think maybe it's a poker play, Eric, but don't you also think it's a legitimate, sincere nomination by the president?
I don't think so. No, not exactly. I'm too cynical, but
you think that the truer Obama nominates somebody more
Patrick more like Sonia Sotomayor, Elena Kagan, someone who's going to more excite the Democratic base and is going to follow in his footsteps. I mean,
what's the harm in this? I mean, if it's a compromise, what's so bad about that?
Well, because the other side isn't going to compromise. If you think a president Ted Cruz or a president is going to nominate the equivalent just to the right of middle of center kind of justice, if he's elected, that's crazy. You're going to get.
But I'm not. But are you being critical of this nomination?
Yes, I am. I think Obama should have thrown a longer pass. I think that he.
Wow.
Yeah. I mean, I do.
What's the matter? Why would you say that? This is the one. Not only is it brilliant politically.
Brilliant politically. Why?
Well, because aren't we concluding that this is making it more difficult for the Republicans to say no? Here's the president meeting them in the middle. He's been described to me anyway as not a liberal, but as a swing vote. It's not necessarily predictable how this guy would vote.
That's playing softball in a game that's otherwise hardball.
I think he also doesn't want, in case, I don't think he wants his nominee to also just completely get swept aside. I think only once, one time the Senate actually outright, you know, rejected a Supreme Court nominee. So this is someone who...
Justice Bork, it would have been Bork.
It was Bork,
yeah,
correct.
In the 80s?
Mean, yes. So I think he's nominating someone who he thinks might actually be palatable to a Republican nominee.
Exactly. I mean, that's why they don't want to have the hearings, because they don't want to go on record.
He's playing an asymmetrical game. Like I said, if the Republican wins the White House, he's not going to nominate somebody who is the, like I say, the right side of the middle of the road.
Yeah, but if he nominated someone who is clearly left, you know, on the left end of this, it would be easier for the Republicans to say, no, he's out of step with the American people.
And you gin up the voting public. You get more people coming to the polls.
Totally. That's the president playing the game.
I think by choosing a middle of the road candidate, he kind of knocks out all of those bullet
points. It's never worked. It's never worked for Obama to play the middle of the road. Well, he tries to negotiate. Like I said, he tried to negotiate on health care. Ultimately, he couldn't get any Republican buy-in on anything that he did. So he just went and did the biggest plan that he could do.
You know what I think, though, Eric? Is this is like the NFL draft day. You know, you choose in the second round a defensive tackle or something, and you think you know what you've got. Well, he's chosen a defensive tackle that he thinks can get through the Senate. This could be one of those picks that ends up becoming conservative down the road.
It could be he could be the Democrats' suitor. Right?
Exactly, yeah. Exactly.
He could be.
Just to get him through.
Yeah, and that'll be a great legacy for him to leave. I'm serious. I thought his first choices were good. I thought Sotomayor and Kagan were good choices. And this is
you just seem like someone who wants to play the game more, Eric.
Really do, because I think the other side is playing the game. I think this is Obama's.
Now you're Mitch McConnell. Now you're the very same thing. You're not accommodating either side.
I don't look as much like a turtle,
John. I think you're playing the game, John. I think you're advocating Obama not picking someone who's true to his style and form in order to play the game and get someone through or to embarrass the Republicans. Eric is saying stick to your guns and stay left.
Well, that's it. I don't like political appointments for the Supreme Court. I like people who are qualified, and this guy seems qualified. And if he's a swing vote, meaning he could go either way, isn't that kind of perfect? Isn't that exactly what you want? Somebody interpreting the law, not the politics of it?
I do.
See?
Thank you. We've predicted before how some of these nominees get appointed, and they are unpredictable. I mean, who would have guessed that Roberts was the one to derail the Obamacare?
It's the Mincing Rascals. You can hear the full podcast at WGNplus.com, and you can subscribe to the Mincing Rascals on iTunes. And maybe you've got something to say about it, too. I'll take a break here, and you can line up with your phone calls. 312-981-7200. Your thoughts on that? Chicago's very own. How much fun would it be if he became... Well, maybe you don't agree, because we all look at this through our own filter, don't we? But everything I saw about him, everything I've read about him, sure sounds to me like a safe choice. 312-981-7200. John Williams on WGN. John Williams on WGN until 3 o'clock. The boys from The Beat will preview their show with us a little before 3 o'clock. We'll talk some sports with them. Gosh, what will we talk about? I don't know if Hulk Hogan is a sports story, by the way, but were you as flabbergasted as I was? $115 million? Let's go back to the topic at hand, though. We were talking about the Supreme Court Justice nomination by President Obama, and I plumb forgot the name of our caller. Who's going to join us on Michelle? Michelle, this is John. You're on the air. How are you?
Hi, John. I just thought that Mitch McConnell has this, you know, strong principle that we're going to let the voters decide. Well, you know, I agree with Steve that we already decided, but they also gave themselves an out that in November, if we elect someone they don't like, then we might just push this nominee through anyway. So much for principles, you know.
That's interesting.
Or are they deciding?
So that's getting to have it both ways. You're saying, okay, so this one is hanging out there, and that might be palatable to some people, even some Republicans. But if Hillary, you're saying, won the election, then they'd go ahead and rush it through. Before...
Yeah, they've given themselves kind of that leeway, and they even said that. So it depends on who wins in November. Then we'll decide whether we're going to let this one go through. But there's a strong principle that we have to let the voters decide.
I hear what you're saying. By the way, just as a question, what kind of do you have a sense of who Donald Trump would appoint as a Supreme Court justice?
Well, John, he would ask the experts. You know, he'd ask the best experts. I don't think he even knows.
I mean, I don't know if he'd be really liberal or really conservative. I think he might
appoint
Melania. I mean, I have no idea on that, you know? It's very strange. Okay, thanks for the phone call on that.
Sure.
Appreciate you chiming in. We'll get you to WGN Radio News here in just a minute. And then in the next hour, we'll talk to Scott Ellsworth. His book is The Secret Game. This is a fascinating story. In the 1940s, basketball was changing. It was becoming a little bit more like the game that you and I know, but it was certainly segregated back then. And the fact that it was a wartime also changed the dynamic of who was playing and what integration was like. And he wrote a story about a secret game where, for the first time maybe ever, a team of really good college black basketball players played a team of really good white college players just to see what would happen. And the story of that game, who won, how they played, what the consequences of that could have been, It's just fascinating. So we'll talk to Scott Ellsworth in the next half hour. After the news on WGN. This is John Williams. By the way, I've lost a lot of productivity this week, not just because of the NCAA basketball tournament. I mean, good Lord, was I not productive during the 2 hours of the Butler game. And if I had to be doing something tonight at 6 o'clock, I would not be doing it well, or 6:10 or 6:30 or whenever the Butler game starts, because it is so, I don't want to say important to me, but to my happiness and well-being, it kind of is. So I've wasted a lot of time on that. One other thing that I have been watching a lot this week that you might look at just for the fun of it, if you want to get away from it all, is Google DNR, Department of Natural Resources, Eagle Cam. And in St. Paul, Minnesota, there is a nest that may weigh 2 tons, high in a tree. And in it are 2 bald eagles and their 3 chicks. And what has been going on there is amazing. The camera zooms right down on it. There's another Eagle Cam in Washington, D.C., which is getting a lot of press today, but just because it's an Eagle Cam, too. They're all cool, and this one, they haven't had eagles in captivity, not in captivity, but, you know, online in the Washington, D.C. area forever, so that's a big deal. But the one in Minnesota, the eagles are a little older, and the mom and dad are bringing fish and squirrel and rabbits up there, and the way they live their lives and the way they tend to those birds is really fun. It's just amazing.
And I've seen a lot of people posting it on Facebook and stuff.
Yeah.
Mine's still loading right now. I think a lot of people must be on it.
Isn't it funny? Yeah, I've actually posted links on my Facebook pages to it, and it's hard once you start watching to stop because it's a very busy nest. Let's talk to Scott Ellsworth. The Secret Game is his national bestseller. It is about a game of basketball played in 1943. Scott, this is John Williams. Welcome to WGN Radio. How are you?
I'm doing fine. Thanks for having me on, John.
By the way, are you still teaching at Michigan?
Yes, I am. In fact, I'm calling you from my office as we speak.
You're not going through the same sort of distraction with the NCAA tournament that the rest of us are, then?
Well, of course I am, but I mean, a chance to be on your show and to talk to friends in Chicago. No, it's just been a mind-bogglingly wonderful tournament so far.
Well, at least you've got Michigan State bowing out early, so a Michigan guy must love that, huh?
Well, you know, I hate to tell you, but I'm also a Duke alum, so you got to be true to your school. And the last I checked, we were still alive against Yale.
Yeah, Duke and Yale are playing right now. And last I saw, the score on that was maybe 3-point difference. So we'll follow that one here. Let's talk about your book, The Secret
Sure.
Game, 1943. Just walk us back a little bit and tell us how this came about and who were the two teams.
Sure. Well, I mean, in what it really was, it's the game that should have never happened. So this is it's actually 1944. It's 72 years ago today, on March 19th, 1944, in Durham, North Carolina, during the absolute height of Jim Crow, of racial segregation. There was a secret, clandestine, very gutsy, integrated college basketball game held in a locked gymnasium on a Sunday morning when everyone, including the police in Durham, North Carolina, were in church, between a black college team and a white wartime team. The African-American team was from what was then known as the North Carolina College for Negroes. It's now North Carolina Central University. And the white team was from the Duke Medical School. It was a military team. There were a lot of those during the war. And this event is just it's crazy. It happens 11 years before the beginning of the Civil Rights Movement. It happens 20 years before the Selma March. In fact, it happens 3 years before Jackie Robinson desegregates baseball, and that's in Brooklyn, New York. So this was a very gutsy, courageous game that these young men pulled off. They had no invited spectators, but they did have a referee and a score.
So it was secret because they feared for their safety, or were they just thought we'd be embarrassed if the black kids beat the white kids?
It's sort of forgotten today. But if you during segregation days in the South, I mean, you could a lot of bad things could happen to you if you crossed the color line. In fact, there was a black GI in uniform in Durham that same year who wouldn't move all the way to the back of a city bus. Got into a verbal argument with the bus driver when they came to the end of the line, the white bus driver murdered the black soldier, and an all-white jury exonerated the white bus driver after deliberating for 20 minutes. If you crossed the color line, if you did things you weren't supposed to do, you could lose your freedom, your career, you know, and in some cases your life as well. So this was a big risk these guys were taking.
Talk about that Duke team. You said it was a military medical team of students. Where was the regular Duke team? Where were the traditional powers?
Well, they were there. You know, the funny thing, John, is when the United States went to war, college basketball went to war, too. And what happened is throughout the country, there were all these military teams that the Army, the Navy, and the Marine Corps created. And they were for morale purposes. And they were really terrific. In fact, the best, quote, college basketball team in 1943, 1944 was from right there in Chicago. It was the Great Lakes Naval Station team. They beat Michigan. They beat Illinois. They played all these regular colleges. They had a young star from Indiana, a guy named John Wooden, who played for them. And so it was the same at Duke. And in the medical school, there was a hurry-up program to create as many doctors as we could for the military. And they had this team of all-stars. They had an All-American from West Virginia, an All-Southern Conference center, a member of the Duke Blue Devils Southern Conference championship team. In fact, the medical school team played the regular Duke varsity, and they slaughtered them. This was a really terrific team. And it's funny to think about that, but during the war, we had all these military teams that really acted like college teams.
So if, yeah, all things were equivalent, if they were in some form in existence today, they would have been as good as the 64 field we have now.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. No question about it. Absolutely.
And then talk about the other team, the College for Negroes team. I mean, what were they like? Who were they?
Well, they were, you know, they were actually, they were an amazing team. They were the highest scoring college basketball team in the United States that season, black or white. You know, in those days, an average college score, you know, game score, a college team would score maybe 40 or 50 points a game. The North Carolina College Eagles were scoring 70, 80, 90 points a game. They beat one of their opponents 103-26. And the reason for this is they had a genius by the name of John McClendon as their coach. McClendon was an African-American, originally from Kansas. He was the last student of James Naismith, who had invented basketball back in 1891 in Lawrence in the 1930s. And McClendon was ahead of everyone. He realized that he was going to create this revved-up fast break. He's the one who really introduces the full-court pressure defense. He invented the four corners. And he also is a pioneer with conditioning. He was a genius. He was ahead of his time. And he created this, you know, a team that would very much look like one of the teams we would see today, only it was 30, 40 years ahead of its time.
Were the team taking one-handed shots, or was it two-handed set shots?
Oh no, they were taking one-handed shots. The McClendon's team, they would move the ball down. They would take the ball end to end within 3 seconds and get a shot off. I mean, there was just really nothing, you know, nothing really quite like them and what they were doing. The problem was, though, is that the black colleges, which were normally in the South, in those days they weren't allowed to play in the NCAA tournament. They weren't allowed to play in the NIT. And so even though McClendon had made this breakthrough, there was no television, of course, at the time. And he was always wondered, well, how would his team fare against a white team? And that was one of the appeals for him eventually in playing the secret game against the team from Duke.
So how did the two teams get together?
Well, it came through two different things. There were what I discovered, John, in doing this book, researching this book over nearly 20 years, is that there's sort of a forgotten precursor to the civil rights movement that happened in the South during World War II. There were whites and blacks as well who were a great personal risk who were fighting back against segregation. And there were some groups in Durham who were doing that, including a couple of Christian student groups, one at North Carolina Central, one at Duke. And the young students there are looking forward to creating a new world when we're done defeating Hitler and Germany. And they started to have secret integrated prayer meetings at night, very dangerous thing to do. And out of that idea came the idea of playing the basketball game.
So somebody said, all right, I'll contact the black team, you get the white team. Did the teams like the idea at first, or was there some resistance there?
Well, there was resistance mainly because at the Duke team, almost all of the players were all Southern, and you know, there were just certain ways that you behaved, a certain mindset that you had, and many of them didn't like the idea. But there was a Westerner, a Montanan by the name of Jack Burgess, who had come to Duke for medical school in the Army. And he had had a black teammate at the University of Montana at the beginning of the war. He had grown up alongside an Indian reservation and played with Indian kids. And he didn't have a racial problem. And when he came to the South, he was sort of horrified at the whites only, no colored allowed signs, things like that. And he was very much in favor. And it took him a while to convince his white teammates to play. But eventually he challenged their manhood. He asked them whether they were chicken or not and finally got under their skin. And so the two teams met and played.
I'll pause here and we'll talk about the game itself. That's not anticlimactic, but it's not the last few pages of your book. In fact, what happened after the game is beyond sweet, but I'll start there. I was so happy to hear what happened after the game as well. I'm playing back scenes from Hoosiers in my head and then repopulating it with your characters and issues.
Oh, that's great.
and making it, I mean, where's the movie on this? Have I missed the movie, Scott?
I have to say, first of all, let me just say Chicago has been beautiful for the Secret Game. The Chicago Tribune named it one of the top 10 books of the year. It recently won a Penn Book Award in New York City, the Penn ESPN Book Award for Literary Sports Writing. Sports Illustrated named it one of the best sports books of the year. But, no, I'm happy to report that Legendary Pictures out in Los Angeles, who did 42 and Unbroken and Straight Outta Compton, have optioned the movie rights. So, you know, who knows what will happen, but fingers crossed on that.
Don't let Angelina Jolie produce it, okay?
I'm sure I'll have a lot of say.
Well, let's just finish this story in a minute. So the book, it's called, the book is The Secret Game. Scott Ellsworth is on a line. We'll finish the story in a minute on WGN. If you want to read a great book, read The Secret Game. If you're really into sports or basketball, we'll bonus round for you because Scott Ellsworth has written one of those books that tells you about a sport or a game, but really tells you about a time. It tells you about us. What was life like in the 1940s in wartime United States of America? And the story of the integration, the first integrated basketball game in the South, is remarkable. And you kind of scratch your head. You never even thought about this sort of thing, Scott, but I guess there had to be a first, and lo and behold, you discovered it and told us the story so well.
Thank you. Thank you, John. Appreciate that.
And in fact, was that known, though, or when did you, Laura Hillenbrand, I
discovered it by mistake. I just very quickly, I was writing a different book on college basketball in the 1950s, and I went up to the Basketball Hall of Fame in Springfield, Mass., and was doing research in the library, and I wandered down. They were having a induction ceremony, and this elderly gentleman, who happened to be John McClendon, introduced himself to me. We started to talk, and I realized, oh, my gosh, he had known James Naismith. So I called up the sports editor of the New York Times, and I said I'd like to do a profile of McClendon for the newspaper. And when I went to interview McClendon then in Cleveland, that's when he told me about The Secret Game, and that's when my other book, Sunk Beneath the Waves Forever, and I was off on the trail of this larger story.
When Laura Hillenbrand was writing Unbroken, no, when she was writing Seabiscuit, she would be going through the old archives, and she was also hearing about this track star. And so she wrote Seabiscuit, but then thought, I got to go back and figure out who that track star was. And then obviously gave us her other great book as well. It's just so interesting the way you all come to these. So then you end up telling the story about this integrated game that took place. Literally, they locked the gym door, the two teams played. And it was pretty clear that one side was much better than the other, right?
It was, and we won't spoil everything for our listeners, but the game began one way and it ended up the next way. Let's put it that way.
It was, one team doubled the other's score. By the way, and then afterwards, they say, okay, that was fun or whatever, And then they go, let's play some more. And they played another game. And in this one is where it was whites and blacks playing together on the same teams.
Yeah, and it just happened by chance after they'd played this game and everybody relaxed a little bit. A couple guys start goofing around, you know, shooting the ball. One guy come out, somebody else will come out. They ended up mixing their squads and played a skins and shirt game. So as big of a violation of segregation as the first game was, the second one was, you know, even greater beyond that.
Did they make any press with this afterwards? Did anybody announce to the world, guess what happened? And
well,
by the way,
here's the story. So there was a young African-American reporter for the black newspaper in Durham who caught wind of the story. He showed up, he took notes, he wrote up the story, and he realized he had the scoop of a lifetime, that would be a story that'd go out all over the country. But he also realized that if he wrote the story and it got published, that Coach McClendon would get fired, that all the students would get kicked out of the schools, and he decided that was too high of a price. So he tore up his story, and official word of the game never came out. Although there were people who knew about it. I've talked to people who, 25, 30 years later, remembered the game, knew that the game had happened, it's part of this whole civil rights struggle. It's before the civil rights movement happens. But this was an important moment, and particularly for the lives of these young students at the North Carolina College for Negroes who realize if I'm on an equal playing field with a white person, I can do just as well. And it's liberating for them.
Last sentence of the book goes to a Senate proceeding. And as the senator-elect droned on about Negro schools and Negro leaders and Negro progress, there could still be heard the sound of shoe leather being scraped across the auditorium floor like the first whisperings of a rising wind. Oh, that's good stuff, sir.
Thank you, John. I appreciate that.
It's nice to talk to you, Scott. Keep up the good work, we can't wait to see the movie as well.
Thanks, John. I'm really glad to be on the show. Thanks for having me.
The Secret Game is Scott Ellsworth's book, A Wartime Story of Courage, Change, and Basketball's Last Triumph. We'll pause, update you on the news. Our Vibe Score segments, where you score the news. It's a kind of whip around all of the things that have been going on in the culture. We'll talk about that coming up on WGN.
The key to everything, I call for Sunday.
And we do this Saturdays a little bit before 3 o'clock, before the boys from the beat come in. Vibe Score is an app that I developed with my cousin Tom Hegberg. You can get it free. It's called Vibe Score. Vibe Score is one word, V-I-B-E-S-C-O-R-E. You get to score the news. Follow groups that are of interest to you. We'll feed you stories in those categories. But then we always ask you a question about that story, and we ask you to score it. For instance, if you're following music, we just gave you the new Iggy Pop Sunday. Question is, how awesome is that song?
Awesome.
All right, Mr. Yeah, that's a good song, isn't it? I hadn't heard that until I actually first heard it on Vibe Score, and I thought, because I don't listen to Iggy Pop that much. That's a good song, isn't it? 1 to 100, then. 100 is best song ever. Dan Long, what do you give it?
I like to give myself some room, so I'm going to go 70.
And in your mind, though, that's not bad, right?
Yeah, in my mind, that's pretty good.
I never give anything 100. I never give anything a 50. I never give anything a 0, kind of because I think, you know, something maybe could be better. 50 to me is too indifferent, and nothing is ever a 0 to me. So the highest I ever go is about a 95 anyway. I'm an 80 on that one, which to me is a pretty good score as well. And what's it trending right now? Let me see what the Vibe score for that so far is. 79. So what do you know? I'm in the wheelhouse with most folks on that one.
Yeah, I do 80 as well.
We had to. Oh, yeah, hey, Bob, you're going to play along? Good.
Sure.
Okay, so let's do the Adam LaRose story then. Everybody's talking about that. And here's the way we posed the question. did Kenny Williams make the right decision or not? Kenny Williams sat him down and said, you got to dial it back. Hit me halfway, 50%, Kenny Williams says. And we all know what happens. LaRoche leaves the team and $13 million. So we're asking on VibeScore, did Kenny Williams handle it right? 100 would be yeah, all the way with Kenny. And a 0 would be no, Kenny did it wrong. What do you guys say? We'll start with you, Bob. What do you give Kenny's performance on this story?
I can't really say just because I wasn't there for it. So the fact that he said anything, I don't, that's a very nuanced relationship.
So you're holding out that maybe Kenny made a deal with him and yeah. It's this is Kenny's bad, huh?
Maybe. I don't know.
Okay, it's, boys. Yeah, well, this was easy for me. I was 89 with Kenny Williams. You know what? Even if the boss is changing the rules in the middle of the game, he's the boss. It's a big organization. We're a baseball team, not a daycare. So this was an easy one for me. Right now, it's getting a 68, so I think it's more difficult for people like you guys are suggesting than I would have thought. Are you worried about the Chicago Blackhawks in the Chicago sports category? We're asking you about the Hawks losing 4 in a row. Kessler, what do you give the Hawks? 100, no trouble at all. 0, we've got a crisis here.
Let's go with 90. They'll come back.
90, yeah. That's kind of my attitude, too. How about you? Do you follow the Blackhawks there, Dan?
I do, yeah. And I'm at about, which way did we score this? Is higher, we're not worried?
High is, yeah, they'll be fine.
Okay, yeah, I'm at about an 85. They always seem to hit the March doldrums and then turn it around as soon as April hits.
Your vibe for the Blackhawks is an 85. They'll be good. What do we make of Barack Obama's Supreme Court pick? You could say 100, meaning absolutely love him. Get him in there right now, and 0 would be 0. Right now, it's trending a 72. 72. Well, there's some. It's funny, too, because when you score, you can also comment. And that's where it gets kind of fun. You'll see people bickering back and forth or agreeing on the various questions that are posed. I gave it a 90. How about you guys? Want to chime in on that one at all, Dan?
Yeah, I'm thinking. I'll give it a 92. Just because I think he did the safe play, as far as picking somebody where it would expose the Republicans for blocking it just to block it, as opposed to being in a political position.
Food and drink.
Yes.
What he said.
Yep.
Food and drink. Corned beef. You know, with the Irish this week and all. Corned beef. We didn't even throw in the cabbage. I think we just said corned beef. I love the corned beef with some potatoes and some carrots. I'm not the cabbage guy, but corned beef, I give a 92. Woohoo! Hey, Kessler.
I'm
going to
give
corned
it.
Beef?
Yeah, corned beef. I'm like 90% of the way to being vegetarian, so meat is like a special treat. So, yes, I'm with you.
Oh, okay. Yeah. I don't know people like that, but if I asked you over, you'd have a little. But then you wouldn't eat meat again for a while.
Probably
huh?
Another week, maybe, till the next time you
wow.
ask me over.
And why do you do that, Bob? I can't understand that.
You know, I feel better having cut back on the meat consumption. I really do. It's, I just think it's, I tried it, and I just kind of fell into it, and I'm like, this is working. So I'm sticking with it.
I can believe that,
yeah.
But I don't know that I have the discipline to do that. Then somebody would drop a steak in front of me, and I'd say, yeah, I'm going to go ahead and eat this instead. By the way, speaking of food, Top Chef finale. We asked you last week what you thought of the finale of, what was the show, Griff? The finale of Downton Abbey, and that got was either 95 or 98. It was the highest 95. It was the highest vibe score we ever gave or got from somebody. The Top Chef finale right now is tracking at 86, by the way. You guys watch that show at all, Top Chef?
I haven't seen it, so I can't say anything.
It's a good show, really good show. Let me do one more here for you. Oh, wait a minute. Stand by. My screen just closed out. 1, 2, 3. And finally, oh, yeah. Poor Marco Rubio. We asked you to once and for all give us your vibe score for Marco Rubio and his campaign, and he hit a 44. You know what was interesting to me is that Rubio was so good afterwards. I thought his goodbye speech was really good, really sweet, really sincere, hit a lot of right themes, wasn't vindictive and mean, didn't completely throw Trump under the bus, although he could have. And it was, this is what always happens. When he gave his concession speech, I said, that's the guy I wanted to vote for. Where was this guy for the last 3 or 4 months? Everybody, when they either drop out of a race or lose a race, you know, John McCain, think how good his Mitt Romney's speech was, so gracious. You liked Al Gore more after the fact. They're always a better version of themselves when they aren't running. So that's what we do. It's called Vibe Score. It's one word, V-I-B-E-S-C-O-R-E. We'll feed you the news and you score it.